Our next speaker is Bill Abraham from Ohio State University in Columbus, and he's going to be speaking on options up and alternatives to the control group in device trial.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to join you today. I want to thank the meeting organizers for inviting me to participate. And as noted, we're going to talk about options of and alternatives to the control group in device trials. And I think Stuart has set the stage for this discussion very nicely. My disclosures are shown on this slide. And so let's first take a look at control group options for device trials. And we're going to focus on ultimately randomized controlled trials and parallel control groups. But I wanted to start with an overview of all the options which exist. And one option is to have no control group. Perhaps that puts us in the realm of an observational trial or a registry. Some trials have compared results to objective performance criteria or to a goal. And this may be another form of having no control group, but at least some benchmark or bar is set prospectively for outcome. Historical control groups, longitudinal control groups where patients serve as their own controls in a before and after comparison, and then the parallel control group, which really permits execution of a properly designed randomized controlled trial. So I am going to focus on parallel control groups and look at the various options which exist in the setting of device trials. Here are the main options. Now, these are the ones that I can think of and have had experience with in trials, both those that I've been involved with and those published in the literature, although maybe the panel will think of some other options for device trials. But perhaps one of the most common parallel control group options used in device trials is to test a device against optimal medical therapy alone. So the control group is optimal medical therapy alone. The treatment group is optimal medical therapy plus a device. Other options include optimal medical therapy, which really serves as background to all of these options, plus surgical therapy, optimal medical therapy plus an active comparator that is a similar device, and optimal medical therapy plus a sham control. And I'll end with a discussion of sham controls, but I'll tell you now and I'll reiterate then that I think sham controls are underutilized in device trials. So let's take a look first at option number one, which is optimal medical therapy and how we define it. And this and the next few slides are really intended to convey the message that optimal medical therapy needs to be very well defined. If it's going to serve as our background therapy and control group in a device trial. So it needs to be defined with rigor, and it needs to be achieved in patients pre-randomization in trials. So optimal medical therapy now includes optimal drug and device therapy, generally defined by national or international practice guidelines, such as those from the ACC, AHA, or ESC, or standard of care. Optimal usually means best tolerated drugs and doses that is achievable rather than maximal doses. But again, the caveat here is that, you know, patients really should have been advanced to the highest tolerated doses of these medications before enrollment into a randomized controlled trial. So if patients are entered into those trials on inadequate optimal medical therapy, and a lot of medication changes occur post-randomization, they can serve to confound the results of the study. This serves, as mentioned, as the background standard for both the control and treatment arms against which most new or investigational interventions are tested. Optimal medical therapy is generally used alone when a surgical comparator is not indicated due to efficacy or safety limitations, and when no active comparator exists. And that may become a bit clearer as we go through some of the other options, and I'll give you some examples of when a surgical comparator or an active control might be appropriate. So let me just take you through a definition of optimal medical therapy. This is a definition which has been used in several recent device trials in heart failure. I show it simply as an example and really an example to demonstrate the rigor with which these definitions should be included in the design of device trials. So in this example, which will comprise this and the next couple of slides, you can see that optimal medical therapy was defined as stable, optimally up-titrated medical therapy recommended according to current guidelines as standard of care for heart failure, and went on to say that this includes at a minimum an angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor at a stable dose for 1 month prior to enrollment if tolerated, and an evidence-based beta blocker using one of the three agents listed for 3 months prior to enrollment if tolerated, with a stable up-titrated dose for at least 1 month prior to enrollment. Stability was defined as no more than a 100% increase or a 50% decrease in dose. The recommendations also then went on to say that if an ACE inhibitor is not tolerated, an angiotensin receptor blocker at a stable dose for 1 month prior to enrollment should be given. I'm not going to read each of the lines on this in the next slide to you, but again, I show these just to show you the rigor with which these definitions should be prospectively built into clinical trials design, because optimal medical therapy can vary from site to site, and the level to which drugs are titrated can vary from place to place. And the goal here is to make sure that all patients enrolled in the study achieve a comparable level of background therapy or optimal medical therapy. And again, as mentioned, this includes not only drug therapies, but evidence-based device therapies, for example, cardiac resynchronization therapy and implantable cardioverter defibrillators as well. Now, this slide presents just an option of what might be achievable, although admittedly this is open to debate, and I think it might be interesting for the panel to discuss what really defines optimal medical therapy. Certainly the goal is to titrate to as close to maximal therapy as possible, but we know that many patients don't achieve maximal or target doses. So looking at a number of recently published trials in heart failure, including both drug and device trials, as well as one registry, the IMPROVE-HF registry, you can see that in general, the percent utilization of neurohormonal inhibitors and antagonists is very high. I'm using the example of beta blockers, but the data look almost identical for ACE inhibitors and ARBs. So you see that about 90% of patients enrolled in these trials were taking a beta blocker. But when we look at the mean beta blocker dose or the percent of patients at target dose, you'll see that they fall far short of those maximal doses or target doses and fall far short of 100% achievement of those target doses. So on average, in carvedilol dose equivalents, patients are achieving about 50% of what would be the recommended maximal dose, and only about a quarter of patients are actually achieving the target dose in our heart failure clinical trials. Now, is that the best we can do in the real-world setting or not? I think that is open to debate, and certainly some recent trials have included committees to try to promote optimization of medical therapy in these patients so that before patients can be enrolled, they have to actually be reviewed by a centralized committee that needs to approve the patient on the basis of achieving optimal medical therapy or not. The second option is optimal medical therapy plus surgical therapy, and this option might be pursued when surgical therapy is the standard of care and subjects are acceptable surgical candidates. So an example here would be in acceptable surgical candidates with degenerative mitral regurgitation meeting guideline recommendations for mitral valve replacement, that is surgical mitral valve replacement, these patients can be randomized to investigational percutaneous mitral valve devices versus surgical replacement. So in this case, the patients have an indication for surgery. Surgery is the standard of care. So if we're going to introduce a new device alternative to surgery, here a percutaneous approach to repairing the mitral valve, the comparator might be most appropriately surgical therapy. Now we could think of another example where surgical therapy wouldn't or might not be the appropriate therapy, and using mitral regurgitation again as the example, this could be functional mitral regurgitation in patients with dilated cardiomyopathy where surgical therapy has not yet been established as a standard of care. And in that case, perhaps ongoing optimal medical therapy might serve as the appropriate control to a trial of percutaneous mitral valve repair in functional mitral regurgitation. The third option is optimal medical therapy plus an active comparator, and this might be used when a similar device, drug or device is the standard of care. And an example, and perhaps now the most common example in heart failure, is comparing a currently approved left ventricular assist device versus a newer investigational LVAD. So the original first-generation left ventricular assist devices were approved on the basis of control comparisons to optimal medical therapy. But once those LVADs were then approved and established as standard of care in the indicated group of patients, subsequent second and third generation LVADs have been compared to those first generation LVADs for FDA approval. And then the fourth option is optimal medical therapy plus a sham control. And you've heard a lot about the virtues of blinding, which I agree with. Sham controls allow blinding of a device or procedure study. You can achieve single blinding of subjects or double blinding of subjects in managing or assessing clinicians. How can one achieve the latter? That can be done by using the implanting physician as an unblinded third party. So if it's an electrophysiological device, the electrophysiologist may serve as an unblinded third party. If it's an interventional device, the interventional cardiologist may serve as the unblinded third party. But in a heart failure trial, for example, the heart failure investigator and the patient can be kept blinded to the study assignment with the use of a sham procedure and an unblinded third party. It is a means for minimizing bias. As I mentioned, I think it is underutilized in device trials, and the reason why it is infrequently used in device trials is because of ethical concerns, the concern raised that there's a risk of harm with no chance of benefit associated with a sham procedure, and also perceived difficulties in maintaining the blind. Although when sham controls have been used to create blinded trials, in general, blinding has been maintained at a very high level. So I think both of these are perceptual rather than real difficulties with sham controls, but certainly they have led to a low utilization of sham controls. Now, why do I value sham controls so much? It's because not only have observational trials led us to the wrong conclusions in the past, but so have randomized controlled trials, which were unblinded. And let me give you some examples of that. On this slide, perhaps the earliest, most classic example is that of the Weinberg procedure, a surgical form of revascularization, a predecessor to coronary artery bypass surgery, which involved blind implantation of the left internal mammary artery. Based on both observational studies as well as randomized controlled trials, the Weinberg procedure appeared to be both a safe and efficacious procedure. The Veterans Administration in the U.S. Conducted a randomized controlled trial, blinded study with a sham procedure. Now, this is sort of the ultimate sham procedure because these patients had their chests cracked as part of the sham control, and the trial demonstrated no efficacy and demonstrated substantial safety concerns related to the Weinberg procedure, and that procedure then fell out of favor and was no longer performed. Another example
is percutaneous myocardial laser revascularization. Again, prior observational studies as well as prior randomized controlled trials suggested the benefit of percutaneous myocardial laser revascularization in alleviating angina and improving functional or exercise capacity in patients with ischemic heart disease. In a randomized controlled trial that included a sham control from Leon and colleagues published in JACC in 2005, percutaneous myocardial laser revascularization was shown to be of no benefit. Percutaneous tension 3 study, which is employing a sham control in order to better validate the efficacy of renal denervation and hypertension. And I would go on to suggest that even in some of our implantable device trials, such as CRT trials with implanted but inactive devices, these may also be considered as sham controls. The only difference here is that they do eventually eliminate that ethical concern of performing a procedure for no potential benefit, because we can, after a double-blinded period of follow-up, we can turn the device on in the control group. But I would suggest that inactive devices also represent a form of a sham control. And there are many, many other examples that we can use from the literature. So those are the main ways I see as being able to control randomized controlled trials in device trials. I think some have clear indications based on what the current standard of care is, and others are still open to some debate, and perhaps the biggest ongoing debate is in regard to sham controls. Thank you very much.
So, thank you, Dr. Abraham.